is I get to warn everybody, first of all, and remind you that this event is being webcast, so anything you say can and will be seen by the internets. Also to thank everyone for being here. And the way we usually do start off is we'll just go around and do sort of quick introductions so that all of us here and our presenter can get a sense of who's in the room. And then I'll kind of introduce her and we'll get going. So I guess I'll start. As I said, I'm a fellow here. I work mostly on cooperation research, and I also do some stuff related to the internet and democracy project.
And from the Netherlands, Institute for Information Law, and I study search engine law.
I'm Stacey Kennard, I'm ONL.
Darius Adamski, fellow, Fulbright fellow, dealing with some issues on internet and democracy, especially the revealing of the public data and its consequences.
I'm Leo Unger, I'm a first year in the Divinity School, focusing on religion, ethics, and politics.
I'm Lauren Walters. I'm an advisor to Partners in Health and Infante Sano.
I'm Persephone Mion, I'm a fellow here at the Berkman Center with the Media Republic.
Catherine Bracey, Berkman Center staff.
Roxana Myram, I'm a research assistant on the Cooperation Research Group.
Robert Ferris, I'm the research director here at the center.
Yochai Benkler, I'm faculty here.
John Britton. For personal interest that helps companies automate their inventory management.
My name is Karthik, I'm an LLM student, and I'm here with an interesting topic of information technology development.
Paul Ray, 1L, same reason.
I'm Yvette Wan, I'm a journalist for Science Magazine and the Internet.
I'm John Chow, with the field of Web and Standard.
Chris Babbitts, I'm a clinical fellow at the Cyber Law Clinic here at Berkman.
I'm Arashur, Berkman staff.
Yeah, Jones, Berkman staff.
Jules Goins, DC Vista.
Very exciting. So our, one reminder, also as we're going, people definitely should ask questions, but these two projectors tend to function sort of like jet engines for those of us sitting in the front of the room. So if you are asking a question from the back, be sure to speak up. Our speaker today, who we're very lucky and happy to have, is Jennifer Bassell from UC Berkeley, the political science department there, where she is rapidly approaching the completion of her PhD. And this is research that she did towards that. It's actually kind of an adopted version of your job talk right now, which is very exciting to be able to get this kind of hot off the presses research that's going out around the world right now. So. Jen also is a member of the TIER, Technology and Infrastructure for Emerging Regions group, which is part of the Intel Berkeley lab out there. And she just returned from a conference with them last weekend.
Yeah.
So with that, I'll pass it over to you, Jen.
Great. Thank you, Aaron, and thank you all of you for coming on what I know is quite short notice. I'm very excited to see so many people here today. The title of my talk is Public Services Reform and Information Technology in Developing Countries. And I've planned about a 25-minute talk, but I've been warned that people often ask questions. Feel free to ask questions about anything throughout the course of the talk, as well as afterwards. So delivering public services is a key fundamental aspect of government activity, but it's an activity that's often flawed, particularly in developing countries. And as the World Bank has noted, this is often not only because services are inaccessible to many poor citizens in developing countries, but also because when they are accessible, they're of poor quality. Now, the difficulty of accessing services in developing countries is often better understood through the use of visual aids. Here we see citizens in the state of Kerala in India attempting to renew their ration cards, a government service that helps them to access subsidized foodstuffs for below poverty line individuals. So there's a massive crowd here, obviously, and even when the citizens get through this crowd to the actual bureaucrat who can renew their ration card for them, this is often the situation that they face. A single bureaucrat in an office piled high with paper files. Now we can all imagine the difficulties that paper record keeping entail for service delivery. In addition, the interaction of a single citizen and a single bureaucrat creates the opportunity for rent seeking or bribe taking by bureaucrats. So the entire process of service delivery for citizens becomes very difficult. So the broad questions that I ask in this project are, why do governments provide public services? And perhaps more importantly, what are the conditions under which governments will adopt reforms to improve public service delivery? These questions take on a different light in terms of the rise of new information technologies since the late 1990s. New information technologies are seen as offering the promise of e-government, or the reform of government from the basic delivery of services to citizens all the way to the back end in record keeping. And the interest of international organizations has been piqued over the last decade to put effort into providing access to these technologies in the developing world, where citizens are expected to benefit most from the improvement of public services. But despite all of the attention that's been given by organizations like the World Bank, UNESCO, UNDP, in addition to major multinational corporations such as Microsoft and Intel and Accenture, we still continue to see, despite all of this promise, great variation in the adoption of what we might call e-services by developing countries. So this is the question then that I address here today. Why do we see this variation in the use of information technology in developing countries? And I address this question today in the context of India. There's been a huge movement to enact the use of information technology in public services in India. In most cases, this has taken the form of the development of what I term technology-enabled service centers, what are also known as information kiosks, citizen information centers, citizen service centers. And these are centers where citizens can access multiple government services from multiple departments, all enabled through the use of computers and, in some cases, the internet. Now, what are the services that I'm talking about here? Any and most services that are offered by government. Everything from getting a driving license, getting a business license, basic services that you need to access other government services, such as getting access to a birth certificate or a residency certificate, then the distribution of welfare benefits, such as the ration cards that I highlighted at the beginning of the talk, in addition to paying your bills with government, paying your electricity bills, making your income tax payments. All of these things are things from multiple government departments that can be offered in a single location and enabled through the use of technology. But again, despite all of these opportunities, we see significant variation across the Indian states. And before I get into the arguments for why we see this variation, I want to just highlight a little bit why the variation that we do see is a bit counterintuitive. Here's India, and I want to compare two states, the state of Karnataka here and the state of Chhattisgarh here. Karnataka is the heart of India's IT industry. Bangalore is the capital of Karnataka. And there's obviously been huge movement to build the IT industry in Karnataka. In addition, it's a medium-income state. There should be resources available to incorporating IT into government. And so we might expect to see a lot of interest in use of IT in government services in Karnataka. Contrast this with Chhattisgarh. Chhattisgarh is a new state. It was created in 2000 as a carved off from the state of Madhya Pradesh. And it has a below average income as well as below average development indicators. So in Chhattisgarh, we might expect that the use of technology to deliver services is the farthest thing from the minds of government officials. But indeed, what we see is that Chhattisgarh has actually implemented more progressive and more robust reforms than Karnataka. And this is not to say that Karnataka hasn't done anything. As you'll see in the remainder of the talk, Karnataka has implemented e-government initiatives. But the fact that Chhattisgarh's initiatives are so much more comprehensive than Karnataka's is a puzzle that needs to be explained. So what are the possible explanations for this difference? Well, I've highlighted already the fact that economic conditions might be a factor here. States that are more economically developed might have more resources to implement. The literature on the diffusion of policies in the US states also tells us that states might be learning from each other. So early states might be providing a source of learning for later implementing states, particularly their neighbors. And then analysts of Indian policymaking in general have highlighted the fact that electoral competition often plays a role in the adoption of particular types of policies. So the argument here is that when there are fewer states, or fewer parties, excuse me, who hold office in a given state, then the parties in that state will be more likely to provide public goods types of policies. So here we might, given that this is a reform that should benefit large swaths of the population, we might expect that smaller numbers of parties in government would lead to greater provision of IT and public service reform. Then finally, others have argued that the implementation of technology and new technological institutions in general can be related to incumbent politicians' expectations about a political replacement effect. And by this I mean that politicians who are incumbents, if they expect external elites to be the beneficiaries of new technology development in such a way that they might be threatened in upcoming elections from these external elites who have gained benefits, they may be less likely to implement these policies in the long run. Now, what I'm going to argue today is what we're actually seeing is a political power effect. And this is an effect that places emphasis on the dynamics of power within a ruling government, as opposed to the differentiation in power between the ruling government and external opposition. And here, the basis of this is that persistent corruption, which I've already mentioned exists in the process of service delivery, creates entrenched interests in government. Ruling elites have access to corrupt resources, and this makes them resistant to any policies that might threaten these resources. So if we want to observe reform in public service delivery, what we need is to have elites in government who have alternative sets of interests that encourage them to implement these reforms that will contrast with the interests of these entrenched members of government. And not only do they need to have the interest to implement these reforms, but they also have the power to act. So let me dig into the details of this argument a bit more. What are the incentives to a ruling government to implement these kinds of technology reforms? Well, as I've noted, citizens find it very difficult to access public services. Not only is it a time constraint to access these services, but it's a huge additional cost on poor citizens. Transparency International has estimated that citizens in India pay upwards of $5 billion in bribes in a given year to access basic guaranteed public services. And this is not just rich citizens trying to jump ahead in the queue. This is poor citizens as well. As we see, more than $20 million of these bribes are seen to be paid by below poverty line citizens in India. So the introduction of e-services has been shown in some anecdotal case studies to reduce the level of corruption in given service delivery. So there is at least initial evidence that the introduction of these services can improve services access for citizens. So there's a clear potential benefit for citizens from the introduction of technology-enabled services, and as a result, politicians may expect that there's a secondary electoral benefit to them from providing this new public good to citizens. So there is the potential for an electoral benefit to politicians for implementing these services. At the same time, politicians have to consider the electoral costs, and this rests really on the use of bribes in service delivery. So we recognize that it's bureaucrats who are accessing bribes when they deliver services to citizens, and this is through their discretion over which citizens can access the services. But the reality in India is that politicians also access a portion of these bribes. And this is because politicians in India have transfer authority over bureaucrats. And this means that any bureaucrat in any given job is at risk for being moved to another job, which may be less lucrative in terms of the potential for bribes, than the one that they have right now. And so they have an incentive to provide some of those bribes to their political overseers. The politicians then don't use these bribes just to send their kids to better schools or to buy nice clothes. They use these rents to run future election campaigns. Elections in India have become increasingly competitive in the last few decades and increasingly expensive as a result, despite any controls that the Electoral Commission has attempted to put on spending in campaigns. And so corrupt rents provide a very important source of income to politicians who are trying to be reelected and give them some access to funds above politicians who are not in power. So as a result, the extent of corruption in a given region should affect the opportunity costs to lead politicians for implementing new technologies. So now I've told you about the potential costs electorally of these policies and also the potential benefits. So what is it we might expect then that in cases where the expected benefits simply outweigh the costs, we'll see the implementation of these policies? But unfortunately, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And this is because of the dynamics of the party system in India. India has an increasingly coalition-based party system at the state level in addition to the national level. And the form of government, be it a single-party government or a coalition government in the state assembly, is incredibly important for the allocation of power in the state government. So in a single-party system, we see the centralization of power in the chief minister, who is similar to the prime minister in a parliamentary system at the state level. So in single-party systems, chief ministers basically can implement whatever policies that they desire. I've had many people say to me, if the chief minister wants it, it just gets done. So in single-party governments, we should see the implementation of whatever policy it is that the chief minister prefers. However, in coalition governments, policy power is instead decentralized across all of the members of a coalition. So the chief minister in a coalition government will still have power to implement policy, but he or she must take into consideration the interests of the smaller supporting members who hold enough seats that if they choose to pull out of the government, the coalition will fall. And the power is decentralized in these governments through the allocation of ministerial posts. And these ministerial posts, as opposed to in the European parliamentary system, are not preferred on the basis of the power, the ideological power that they have over particular departments. They're instead preferred over the rents that are inherent in that ministry. So in the transport department, as I've said, politicians have control over bureaucratic transfers. Politicians leading the transfer department have control over all of the bribes that bureaucrats, take in when delivering driver's licenses, etc. So that expectation of rents through ministerial posts is a key reason for coalition members to join in a government. As a result, any threats to those rents should imply threats to the stability of the coalition itself. And supporting coalition members should not be supportive of policies to introduce transparency in government, particularly in highly corrupt states. And so we should be less likely to see chief ministers in expecting those coalition members to give up their rents. So what are the predictions that come out of this argument? This argument entails that three key factors should affect the characteristics of technology-based services reforms. First, the level of corruption in a state should affect the negative incentives to implementing a policy. The level of ruling government cohesion, or whether there's a single party or a coalition government in power, should affect the ability of chief ministers to implement these policies and implement them robustly. And then finally, the potential for a positive citizen response, or this positive electoral benefit, should also affect improved service delivery. And so reform, and robust reform in particular, is only likely in those cases where the party leadership both anticipates overall electoral benefits and where they have the power to implement their policies of choice. So I developed and test this argument in subnational comparisons in India, South Africa, and Brazil. And today I'm just going to focus on India, in part because that's the most developed part of the argument to date, and also because it's a very interesting case for doing this analysis. We have a huge amount of state-level policy variation across the Indian states, at the same time that we can control for a lot of political and bureaucratic institutional characteristics that are held constant across all of the states, while the variation in the political variables that I'm interested in is significant. So this gives me a nice opportunity to test these political arguments. And so this is a controlled comparison of state cases in India, and I developed it based on fieldwork in 16 Indian states. The argument itself was developed based on interviews that I conducted in 7 Indian states, and then went back and tested the argument through interviews in an additional 9 states. And this involved interviews with more than 70 government and non-governmental officials in these states, and additional analysis that allowed me to collect data on 4 states that I wasn't able to visit, such that I have a new data set of state policies covering 20 Indian states, which accounts for more than 75% of the national population. So in the broad project, which I can't present all of today, I test a wide range of policy characteristics, all of which in certain ways might affect the benefits that citizens receive from these policies. So this includes the timing of implementation, the number of services that are made available, the number of centers that are made available, the types of services, et cetera. Today, I just have time to talk about two of these things, timing and the quantity of services. I also have some data with me today about the types of services that are available if anyone's interested in that in the Q&A. So policy timing. What explains variation in the moment at which these states implemented a technology-enabled services policy? Here we see the cumulative adoption across the Indian states, with the first state initiating a policy in 1999, and then states following along until 2006, where my analysis stops, where 16 of the 20 states had then implemented a policy. So this is a relatively common S-curve innovation adoption that we see here, but what explains the adoption itself? So what I do to test the timing of these policies is to conduct an event history model. And an event history analysis is similar, also known as a duration analysis or a survival analysis. It's a type of analysis that developed in the biological sciences and industrial analyses, but is now often used when the dependent variable of interest is the implementation of a policy over time. And what it does, it allows me to test not only if a policy was implemented in a state, but also the characteristics of the state at the moment in time when it was implemented relative to other states. And here I include variables for all of the three independent variables of interest, in addition to control variables for a number of the alternative explanations that I presented earlier. And I'm not going to present the results of the entire analysis because you won't be able to read them on the screen, but I'm going to highlight some key variables. So here are the variables measuring my key independent hypotheses and a few control variables. And the hazard ratio here, the way that we interpret a hazard ratio in an event history model is that a hazard ratio below 1 implies that increase in the variable of interest implies a decrease in the likelihood that a state would implement one of these policies, whereas a hazard ratio above 1 indicates an increase in the likelihood that a state would implement a policy. So the corruption variable is the first one in the table. We see that the hazard ratio is below 1. So an increase in the level of corruption in a state is associated with a decrease in the likelihood that a state would implement a policy as predicted by my argument. This is statistically significant at the 0.01 level. The second variable, the Indian National Congress variable, is a measure of whether or not the Indian National Congress as a party was in power in the state. And the argument here is that the Indian National Congress has traditionally had a larger base among poor populations in India, and this changes and varies across the states, but in general has had more of a base among poor populations who are expected to benefit the most from the improvement in services. And so as a result, we might expect the Indian National Congress to perceive the greatest potential electoral benefit from implementing these centers. That is indeed what we see here. The presence of the Indian National Congress as the lead party in a state is associated with an increase in the likelihood that a state would implement a policy. The measure of whether or not there's a coalition government in power versus a single party is not statistically significant, but it is in the direction predicted by the argument, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about the role of coalitions in other cases. And then the variables measuring previous technology infrastructure, we might expect that states with more technology infrastructure in place would be more likely to be able to implement these policies. That is in that direction, but it's not statistically significant. And then again, economic development. We might expect that more economically developed states would be more likely to implement these policies, but that's not the case. It's not statistically significant. So once these policies have been put in place, what do the policies look like? What do they actually provide to citizens? Here you see a graph of the quantity of services that are made available in given centers in a state. On the far right, you see Andhra Pradesh. The state was the first state to implement a policy, and it also offers more than 40 services to citizens through its eSeva centers. Compare that to the state of Tamil Nadu on the farther on the left, which provides at best 10 services to citizens. So while the quantity of services is in certain ways a crude measure of the robustness of a policy, it does give us a sense of the likelihood that a wide range of citizens could benefit in multiple ways from the introduction of these centers in their state, and the differences the significant differences across the states, even neighboring states. So what then explains this variation in services? Let's look first at corruption. So in this table, on the left-hand side, you see the states with below average corruption scores, and on the right-hand side, states with above average corruption scores. And here, in the parentheses, is the number of services provided in each state. Now, I just do a simple difference of means test here to evaluate whether the average number of services made available in below average corruption states differs from that in above average corruption states. And it does. The difference is 9.5, and this is a difference that's statistically significant at the 0.05 level. But what about alternative explanations for quantity of services? Here you see the same data for level of corruption in the top row, and then the same kind of difference of means test for other independent variables. For coalition, we see that single-party governments, which are those on the left-hand side, the left-hand column, offer on average 18 services, whereas coalition governments only offer just more than 11 services, and this is statistically significant at the 0.1 level. Whereas state domestic product per capita, a measure of economic development, is not statistically related to any difference in the number of services provided, nor is the year since policy implementation. We might expect that a state that had implemented in 2000 by now could offer more services than one that implemented in 2004 or 5, but we don't see that in any statistically significant way. So what I want to do quickly is just dig down into this coalition data a little bit more. So we might expect that above average corruption states are not going to offer a lot of services no matter what. In these cases, chief ministers, be they in a single party or a coalition government, are going to see less of a potential benefit relative to the cost of implementing a lot of services. But in below average corruption states, we should see the effects of chief ministers' interests. And here we see a major difference in the number of services provided by single party governments with below average corruption versus those with a coalition government. So single-party governments offer almost 27.4 services on average, whereas coalition governments in below-average corruption states offer just over 11 services. And again, this is statistically significant. So here we see a bit more evidence of the effect of the form of government on the characteristics of these policies. So, conclusions. I think there is evidence that the introduction of these new technologies can provide an opportunity to improve service delivery, and in particular to break the cycle of corruption that exists, in particular in India and in other countries, in the delivery of citizen services. And there is evidence that suggests that this is the case, and this evidence is something that I want to work on investigating a bit more in the future. Because this does mean potentially a multi-billion dollar effect for developing country citizens. But at the same time, my argument here is that these outcomes depend fundamentally on politicians' expectations about the costs and benefits of these policies to them electorally, and on their ability to act on those interests in a particular institutional environment. So as we're thinking about the characteristics of the digital divide, both across and within countries, the argument here is that we need to be paying even greater attention to the ways in which political incentives are affecting technology outcomes in ways that have clear effects on individual citizens. Thank you.
Yeah. Puzzled by, or one of the puzzles, I have two puzzles I was thinking about in talking. One is the situation where adoption of technology services in a state can also be affected by corruption. In other words, affected meaning bribery is possible in the adoption of technology services.
Yep.
So it may be less disaggregated, so if I'm the chief minister or at whatever level, you're paying me off to buy your system or buy, you know, whatever, as opposed to, well, I'm giving 2 rupees if the guy jumps the line.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's one puzzle that I'm, and I would argue that the opportunities for the size of the corruption, in fact, may
be greater,
more substantial than call it nickel and dime corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And it may shift the source of corruption, in other words, the source of the bribe giver,
mm-hmm.
from individual poor people to wealthy people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a social good, I don't know. But I mean, that's one puzzle. The second puzzle is, when you started by describing these two states, one which was more advanced in adoption of newer technologies,
mm-hmm.
But was also less economically developed,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That there may be another reason for that, which is that you know, we often see jumping of technology, jumping
mm-hmm.
development. So cell phones are the obvious example in Eastern European countries and a
yeah.
lot of other places where you jump because it's a better way of delivering services, and you're not stuck in the old way, and there's less of a sort of installed problem.
Yeah.
Like, here's something new.
Great. So those are both great questions, and I'll address them in order. So the first question is very important to this analysis, and as I pointed out, sort of in the middle, there are multiple aspects of these policies that I'm looking at. And so in another part of the project, I'm looking at the number of centers that have been implemented in a state relative to the population of the state. Because like you, I expect that the actual implementation of a center has the potential for bribes involved with it, that companies that are trying to, many of these projects have been implemented in a public-private partnership model, and so the bidding for the project or by individuals or companies has the potential. And it is interesting, in the initial data analysis, I see different types of patterns in terms of the number of centers that are implemented than in terms of the quantity of services, and I think that is related to this other side of corruption that you're talking about. And so while that... I think it happens, absolutely, yeah. So I didn't present that part of the project today, but I think you're absolutely right that there is a shifting of, so you do see states like Rajasthan implemented a very high number of centers per capita with very few services in them. And so Rajasthan's a very high corruption state. So low corruption states also implement a large number of centers. So it's sort of there's a bit of a curve there. Oh, it doesn't mean they're not corrupt either. Absolutely not. Because there's corruption in every state. It's all just relative.
So what are the implications? So if you divide that, what are the policy implications if you're trying to increase the adoption of more services, more technology services, get away from the paper picture?
Mm-hmm.
But the answer is we just want to do that and just live with corruption because it's part of life.
Yeah, I think there's no promise, interestingly, I don't think there's any promise in discussions of the introduction of technology and service delivery that you'll reduce that high level of corruption, right? I don't think that promise has been made by anyone, that contracting corruption will be reduced. And so, in a certain sense, I might agree with you that it's a public good to shift the corruption to a higher income places. I haven't thought about that enough to really make that claim, but if you're just thinking about public service delivery and improvements for citizens, then I think you could create the right kinds of incentives for private partners, even with bribing in place, such that you could see a reduction in corruption between citizen and government, and that would have its own benefits. I'm going to answer just the second part of the question quickly, sorry. So in terms of Chhattisgarh versus Karnataka, there may be a jumping thing going on here, and there is evidence that the national government implemented a national policy to implement these types of centers in 2006, which is sort of where I stopped my analysis, that's based on a lot of the evidence from the state-level policies that were implemented before that. And it's those states that hadn't implemented state policies that have been the quickest adopters now that the national government policy is in place. So there's questions there about my corruption argument as well that I'm working on. But the reality is I don't think that the use of technology was high in any state, right? So I think all states were jumping. And in that sense, it's still a question why a poorer state was better able to jump than a more well-off state with better access to technology, if that makes sense. I mean, I think all of these states were making a jump in the delivery of services, so I don't know that the jump explains the difference between the two states, because I think the delivery of services was poor in either case. It's just that technology had been more implemented in business, not in government, and the companies were there in Bangalore that you might partner with. Yeah, familiar. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe let's take a couple in a row, and then we'll
let
you aggregate them. So, yeah.
My question was, in terms of your data sets,
were
all these projects that you looked at within the same specific period of time, or were they comparing, for example, if there's a spurt in e-governance and information technology projects in places like Karnataka from 1999 onwards until the end of the S. N. Krishna government, and since then, there has been a lack of political will. So I don't know how the time period really varies over here. So if you were to look at just the time period of 2004 onwards, then you might see instances where Karnataka is really low, while newer states like Chhattisgarh or Jharkhand have a lot more. That's one thing. And the other problem is, as you must have seen in places like Andhra Pradesh, a chief minister, you say, is quite responsible in bringing changes. Chandrababu Naidu, who was the chief minister who brought most number of projects together, really increased the flow of e-governance and information technology projects to the masses. But as soon as he lost his election, the very next election, and he was known as the IT czar and stuff like that, so as soon as he lost that election, probably sent off a signal to a lot of the other parties in these states that there is really no point in pushing these projects forward if it doesn't mean that we're going to get elected the next election that we're going to have. So probably to justify the electoral outcomes or the outcomes of these projects in Karnataka and Andhra Pradesh, it's quite possible that Karnataka suffered from the lack of political will, and all of the other states, even though they have the lack of take-up of these e-governance projects in many of these other states, could be because of the fact that a number of these governments just didn't see the benefit out of rolling out so many projects to so many people, because it just didn't promise that they'd get elected back into power the next time.
That was big, so can I just respond? So the time period, I mean, the analysis that I'm doing, especially in the statistical analysis, sort of time year or state year analysis, so I'm looking at the characteristics in every state, every year. And I'm going to link the two together, because I think even after Krishna left, there was still support of these initiatives in Karnataka. There have been, the Namadi project was implemented under the next government and has had reasonable political support. I think in Karnataka, every government since Krishna, every government takes credit for the Bhumi initiative, which is a land records initiative that is different than the kind of initiative I'm looking at. But I think in general, I don't think that technology initiatives, to get to your second question as well, that technology initiatives are anticipated to have such an electoral benefit that they can win or lose an election if there are a lot of other things going on. But they're sort of on the margin, additional goods to citizens. And after Naidu introduced the policies in Andhra, people in other states have said to me it created this competition in other states, that other governments wanted to be able to show that they could provide goods to their citizens as well. And after Naidu lost, the Congress government came in, they took over one of his projects to open up centers in rural areas and changed the name, said it was their initiative, launched it, even though it had been planned by his government, and took full credit for it, saying that this was what they were doing for the poor rural people that Naidu had never helped. So I think, despite the fact that he lost, people still see that there's this potential electoral benefit, and I think people that really think about Naidu's situation know that there were a lot of other things going on in the state that probably led to his downfall, not just the technology stuff, although I think after a while lots of people didn't see benefits from it. So people have to see benefits from it as well. It can't be something that's only in Hyderabad and and the capitals and only affects a small number of people. Yeah.
Just a follow-up to that. In terms of the electoral base itself of all of these parties, do you see a kind of a you're unable to compare it, because
while the electoral bases are mostly in the rural area as well,
mm-hmm.
a lot of these projects, you know, are never seen.
Yeah.
So you have public service and e-governance reforms in the urban areas,
mm-hmm.
but then your electoral base is in the rural areas.
Right.
So what is your take on the urban-rural divide?
Urban-rural divide. Well, it differs by state, whether they've implemented in urban versus rural areas. I mean, in Andhra, they started in urban areas. In Karnataka, the first initiative was actually a rural initiative. And the Namadi project was started in rural areas, and only later did Bangalore One open in Bangalore, which is their urban initiative. So I think different states have taken different strategies, and in another part of the project I'm trying to look more closely at the specific support bases, both urban, rural, and socioeconomic support bases, to understand how those support bases are related to both where the services were placed, the locations of centers, and the specific services that were made available to citizens. Because I think there are some clear alignments of services that benefit upper classes and middle classes versus welfare-related benefits for lower classes, and those seem to align relatively closely with the support basis of the party that was in power at a moment in time. So I think they're thinking about that as well.
I have just kind of a general interest in how you would characterize sort of the movement to improve the technology available to citizens, especially poorer citizens in India,
mm-hmm.
generally, and how that impacts your analysis of this discussion. And that includes, I guess, taking a different tack on your question, any like major level or maybe even national level government lobbying by large for-profit
mm-hmm.
IT companies,
mm-hmm.
The impact of NGOs who might be really focused in you know, bringing information technology services or just doing investing in
mm-hmm.
that direction. And then also, I guess, the private sector themselves. I mean, the example, I guess, there certainly are business models that would allow for-profit companies or just a company to extract rents by delivering services more efficiently.
Yep.
And I know certainly at the micro level, that kind of work is very much encouraged by NGOs. So I'm just wondering, like, how
yeah.
you would characterize some of those different factors. I mean, I guess the really sloppy stereotype of India is, like, you know, there's development, a lot of enthusiasm about IT, and, you know, a lot of investment going on in that direction. So,
yeah,
what's their influence as a
right.
mass?
So, starting with the for-profit companies, I would obviously, at least at the start, think that the presence of a lot of software companies might be related to implementation. That was, you know, why the results in Karnataka are a little bit counterintuitive to me. And in the event history model, the analysis of the timing of policy implementation, one of the variables that I didn't present is a variable that measures the number of IT software and services companies in a state per capita. And interestingly, that's not related to timing, at least not statistically. It's not an area that I've done a lot of specific questioning of in terms of my interviews, but it's also not something that came up a lot. So in speaking to the third part of your question, there is a role for private companies in these initiatives. As I noted, that there are private sector companies that are involved as public-private partnerships to implement a lot of these. And I think that's been an important part of this movement. And it's a ideological debate that's going on right now among members of the government and the private sector as well, but more so in the government in India right now, what the appropriate role for the private sector is in the delivery of government services. And there's, in the IT department at the central level, a clear debate going on between people that support public-private partnerships and don't. In this national initiative that was launched in 2006, private sector organizations, both for-profit and NGOs, are a key part of the implementation of these centers in the states. I have a colleague who has also been a part of this TIER initiative at Berkeley, who her dissertation was specifically on the role of public-private partnerships in the delivery of services in Kerala and in Andhra Pradesh, and how that relates to the perception of government by citizens as private companies are delivering services that are offered, that are government services. And I'm not going to try to reiterate her argument here, but I'd be happy to give you her name and information because it's a very interesting project. Just quickly on NGOs, NGOs have been a really important part of some of the initial projects in this area, especially at the sub-state level. I think Colin was involved in a project in Tamil Nadu that involved MIT Media Lab and also other organizations to implement technology access centers. And then that project was then taken up by the state government in Tamil Nadu and implemented as one of these state initiatives. So the role of NGOs has been more at this sort of beginning level of funding pilots and funding initial things that then state governments have either taken up or not taken up. And so it's been a really important role, because without that, we might not have seen some of these happen in the first place. But it's not, it's been at that level more than I think at the state level that I've seen NGO activity.
I'm being pestered on the back channel and told that I'm not letting enough people get questions.
Oh,
out,
sorry,
so
and I'm talking too much, probably.
But so maybe let's try doing the multiple
okay.
questions thing, and then we can keep moving. So I don't know who was next over here, but we got a cluster.
So I don't want this to sound like a Luddite. I love technology. the photo that you showed at the beginning of this, like, one gentleman surrounded by a mammoth pile of paper.
Yeah.
I guess many people who've been to India, this would actually be a strange sight, because usually it's about 12 guys all stamping one piece of paper.
Mm. Mm-hmm. yeah, that too, yes.
And so I guess my question would be, if we shift from 12 guys stamping one piece of paper to one computer program doing this, aren't we going to create massive unemployment of the education process? And surely these guys are not trained to actually operate computers. So we'll be shifting employment from these people to people, you know, 25-year-olds fresh out of a degree in computers.
Yeah, okay.
So what do we do with the former civil servants?
Okay.
Well, actually, my question will answer your question a little bit, because, well, I have a similar problem to many people here, and that refers to your first conclusion. New technologies may break cycle of corruption and efficiency. This implies that corruption and inefficiency stems from paper.
Mm.
I come from Poland. That's one of the most corrupted European Union member states, and what I'm sure is that it does not really stem from paper.
Mm-hmm.
It stems from discretion, what you mentioned at the very beginning. And actually, and this is where I jump on Chris' question. Actually, if you want to have anything done now in having these centers, you have to go there, right? And
mm-hmm.
there will be somebody there, one or 12 people. The difference will be simply that they won't have the paper, they will have a screen.
Mm-hmm.
But the discretion will be exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Plus, on the top of this, you will have the discretion in, like, picking up those that will provide hardware and everything
mm-hmm.
To these centers. So that's my first problem. The second stems from my experience.
Mm-hmm.
When you are anywhere in developing countries, you start with meeting people. Well, when you meet somebody, the person probably will ask you for backshish, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something so deeply cultural that you cannot really, like, pull it out so easily. And on the top of this, even if you have a democratic system like in India, then you totally don't control in this hierarchical relationship between policymakers and bureaucrats. You don't really, as a policymaker, as a
mm-hmm.
leader on the top of this, you don't really control what's going on inside there, because it's actually this bureaucracy which levels you up. It's not really the mob, as you know, mob is managed in these places. It's
mm-hmm.
not really that these people that you really represent these people. You represent the power system there, which on the other hand you don't really control. In India there is a very good example which has nothing to do with technologies of enhancing or replacing this inefficient accountability pattern of horizontal control. And I think it was in Rajasthan.
Mm-hmm.
It's an example how this dispersed interest of these poor people striving to get subsidized bread or
mm-hmm.
clean water can be aggregated by something which is an NGO. There was this NGO, it's MKSS,
mm-hmm.
Which was confronting corruption in subsidies of subsidizing bread.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very much efficient. And it was efficient because it was able to aggregate the interests of these poor people and limit the discretion by revealing, by making a coalition which had nothing to do with political leaders,
mm-hmm.
which allowed to control the bureaucrats. But so I agree, the point where I agree totally with you is about the leadership, but I wouldn't look for the leadership in this government structure,
mm-hmm.
because it's totally corrupted. And it stems from this bakshish plea at the very beginning. But I would look for it actually somewhere else, like NGOs, and I'm not really sure if there's any connection with technologies here.
Yeah.
So I greatly appreciated your talk. One of the things that I really enjoyed about it is that I think you provided some outlines for people who are actually working in development to try to establish whether something is going to work or not. As you started offering this, I was reminded of one of my strangest experience working in international development, where I got sort of sent on an Apocalypse Now type mission by USAID to go visit the Customs Department in Kigali, Rwanda, about 10 years ago, and went to evaluate why the more than $50 million that had been put into computerizing the Customs Department had achieved absolutely nothing. And after 2 days, after asking sort of fearsome questions, the director of the Customs Service finally shut the door, shut the blinds, and said, "I don't want to die. Do you want to die?" And I went home at that point and tried to explain to USAID what had happened. Now, what's interesting about this is that Rwanda is very, very different now than it was then.
Mm-hmm.
And one explanation that would sort of come out of your data is to say that you've had a unitary executive. Unitary is a polite word for mm-hmm. dictator who has quashed all possible free speech. And one possible explanation is that by Kagame having absolute sole control of power has managed to implement whatever the hell he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Another flip side would be to say that Rwanda, to a greater extent than any other African state, has sort of made a bet on a digital future in one fashion or another, and essentially to say that either that in combination with having complete unitary power, or simply the idea of sort of saying, no, we're going to be a digital future, may have had some real effect as far as adoption on this. So it would be really fun to sort of look at
mm-hmm.
a couple of case studies and try to figure out whether branding works in all
mm-hmm.
of this, whether sort of deciding at a government level, whether it's a state level or whether it's a national level, that becoming a regional leader within IT and sort of making e-governance and sort of hitting those targets and all the things that the different UN agencies have been telling people to do, whether that actually has any correlation or whether it finally comes down to these sort of other factors of unitary control. It seems to me, though, that where the really interesting test comes in, and the one that I hope you're thinking about and working on, and I suspect you are because you're obviously doing really brilliant research, is to what extent does implementing these services on a widespread basis affect the baseline level of corruption
mm-hmm.
in the long period of time? And, you know, I think the concern with all of this is we've all got sort of fun anecdotal data on it's great that people can now get birth certificates, and we've seen evidence that people do it, but you have precisely the problem that if someone can control access to the system, you can have simply a different choke point for corruption,
mm-hmm.
or you can have lots of pretty shiny demo systems that don't necessarily affect. So
yeah.
I would love it if you would sort of comment on maybe early thoughts on sort of
yep.
what those correlations look
okay.
like.
Okay. So that's three. I'm going to start answering now. So in terms of the ability to overwhelm the cultural history of corruption in a state and also the effect that that might have if you're successful on employment in a place where employment is very important, well, not that it's not everywhere, but the one example I would give is of the Indian Railways, which is a different than my case, because it's a single department that automated. It's at the national level. But if you ask anyone about how difficult it was to get a railway ticket 15 or 20 years ago, they will talk to you about the impossibility of it, the demand for bribes, the queues, everything. Absolutely impossible, right? If you had to know someone, et cetera.
the system was computerized. You can now buy tickets online. You can buy tickets at the railway office. It's completely feasible for me, knowing nothing about the railway system, to get a ticket, although they do still have a special line at the office for foreigners, which is nice. And women, yeah. And I'm both, so that's great. But there has been, in the Indian Railways, they were able to overcome this history of corruption and discretion in delivery through the implementation of a very well-developed system. So I do think that the potential is there. I also think that the Indian Railway still employs a huge number of people. I'm not sure that it's the same people doing the same work. But, you know, it is a question. And in certain cases, I've seen examples of people being retrained. In other cases, I've seen examples of people who didn't have jobs in the first place being brought in, women's self-help groups in particular, other groups being brought in to run the delivery of front-end services, and then still maintaining at the back end the same bureaucrats that were working in the office in the first place. So I haven't heard much fear. I think there's been some fear, at least initially, among bureaucrats of job loss, but it's really been what's I've observed is more reallocation of people in the system, that there hasn't been much job loss. And there's also been restrictions in many states on hiring. So if it's not given out to the private sector, the no one new has been hired to fill those positions, so they've worked it out in a certain way. So people are afraid of losing power in their jobs, but less afraid of losing their jobs than they used to be. So those things are being sort of worked out. The Rwanda example is a really interesting one, and one that I don't know that much about, so I'd love to learn more about it. To the extent, measuring the corruption in the first place, the baseline measure of corruption is a very difficult one. I didn't talk about my measure of corruption, but I used a survey that Transparency International did in the Indian states of citizens, and of citizens' experience with bribing. So it's a really nice survey because it's testing exactly what I'm interested in. But there aren't enough of those. Unfortunately, the survey's not been entirely consistent over time, and there haven't been that many of them to be able to really compare across. I'm working on developing a small experimental project in the near future to try to test the level of corruption in the delivery of services through these centers versus through the traditional model where that still exists. So I will let you know how that progresses, because that's exactly what I'm trying to do, because I don't think that there's enough purely case-based, single case-based research on the effect on corruption.
Do you have a hypothesis? Do you
I think it's improved. I think often it shifts. So you get it in different places. People are very creative, and they find ways to get money through other channels. And so again, that's a question of the effect on citizens from one versus the other, if we're trying to measure the benefits to citizens. But I do think that it's decreased in part because one of the things that's often implemented in these centers is a queuing system, an electronic queuing system, which takes out one of the most simple but profitable forms of discretion, which is speed money. So if you put in the electronic queuing system, people can't pay to get moved up in the queue. It stops the bureaucrats from accepting speed money to move people up in the queue. Well, it doesn't stop them from accepting it, but people are silly if they pay it because they don't actually have control over it. And so that's one very basic form where I think the system itself that's put into these centers can help break the traditional model. It's just through that. So I'm an optimist, and I still hope in my normative heart that that there is some positive effect for citizens, but I'm not gonna say explicitly that there is until I see it myself. Yeah.
I want to see word about the effect on citizens. I actually have worked in South America with the Japanese International Cooperation Agency. And you know, one of the studies that we did about the impact of technology, particularly internet cafes in rural areas, was initially negative in the sense that people actually were more entertained than they were finding useful applications to it. So that's anecdotal. Mm-hmm. But I recently ran into this paper, which you may be interested in, Foreman, Goldberg, and Greenstein. Okay. It's 2,700 counties in the U.S., you know, 1990 to 2000, and looking at the impact of the introduction of advanced internet.
internet-related technologies in
okay.
business, how does that has affected wages?
Mm-hmm.
And they find that there is actually no precise correlation with the introduction of these technologies, advanced internet technologies, they call
mm-hmm.
on actual wage growth, and that there's no difference in terms of bridging the divide, if you will, between the rich and the poor in terms of the wage growth.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do find, though, which is really interesting, is that to the question that was asked at first, they actually find a very significant correlation and impact for those counties that are already highly educated and have high
mm-hmm.
income. So they do benefit directly from the introduction mm-hmm. of newer technologies than others.
Mm-hmm.
So on average, nothing happens. But if you segment them into rich versus poor, then the rich get richer.
They do. Interesting.
It's a very recent paper, so.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe. Sorry, can I
That's
jump
okay,
in?
Yeah.
I was going to say, maybe also that's a part of what you're saying in that paper would be something that I think comes up in Esther's research a lot, which is, you know, with effects of factors like, you know, income in that case may be functioning as a proxy for socioeconomic status as a whole. So you may be getting lots of things that are getting tossed into that income bucket that we can't see that are driving that effect as well, which would be interesting to know also at a broader level. And this speaks, I think, to questions that have come up in a lot of the research here on just sort of what is, you know, sort of a broad question about what is the effect, what does the internet mean for democracy as a whole? It's hard to sort of say, unless you're able to sort of drill in on these more precise areas, how that works out. And it also goes back again to these questions of, well, you know, I know that IND's done a lot of fascinating work on filtering around the world. So where you have things like filtering, where you have questions like bureaucratic corruption and single party states versus sort of multi-party coalitions, it creates a lot of problems for the way that original question is framed. You know, does the internet do such and such? It seems like the internet or information technology as a whole is being thrown into a much broader mix.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm curious what you make of that, too.
Well, also, and just responding to your first point, the interesting thing about these centers in India, which makes them different from internet kiosks, however you want to call them, in pretty much every other country in the world that I've observed, is that citizens don't get access to the technology. So there's no computer sitting there that a citizen can play on and can play games on. The exception to that rule in the state-level cases is the Akshaya project in Kerala, where e-literacy was a key aspect of the implementation of that project. Akshaya also has a project called Friends, which is in urban areas and or in district capitals, which is much more about the delivery of services, like in all of the rest of the states. So in studies of other non-government kiosk initiatives in India, you do see that entertainment is one of the key uses. And I think in other places in Africa, et cetera, entertainment is often one of the key uses by citizens of the internet. And I'm not going to make a normative claim about whether that's bad or good. I think use of technology is a good thing in general, probably. But at least in the cases that I'm looking at, it's the model that's being implemented is different than what you've seen in South America and what we see in a lot of other places. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The interesting point about the paper here is that they are trying to analyze the introduction of the internet in the United States.
Yeah,
in
right.
The effect it may have had. So they're not looking at until 2006 or something. They stopped
yeah.
in 2000.
Yeah.
So
oh, and I was referring
major,
to your first point, too.
You know,
yeah.
With September 11 and all.
Yeah.
So in that 10-year period, they actually observed that, you know, the rich get richer and
yeah.
the poor stay.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I just wondered if you, what Aaron and what Ethan brought up, had a sense of this branding idea. That, it, you
right.
know, is there an equation of e-governance and better democracy
mm-hmm.
in the people who use it? And if, you know, if there's any data sources on that.
I don't know about data sources. I do think that that's what the model that was promoted in Andhra Pradesh, I think that was Chief Minister Naidu's model. He wasn't just about providing government services to citizens. He was about building what was called a smart government, which meant back-end processing. It meant all kinds of aspects of government. And he really did brand himself. He changed, he got people to call him the CEO of Andhra Pradesh as opposed to the chief minister and all of these things. So for him, it was really a branding thing. And granted that we can debate whether that was successful or not. But it did create, as I said, the sense of competition among other states about trying to provide the same source of goods, at least for a period of time. It created that competition. So I think it was only really obvious in Andhra Pradesh and then sort of had a trickle effect into other states. But that's where I've observed that the most part. Yeah.
I worked professionally for many years with high-tech workers from Bangalore. Mm-hmm. And so there's another whole view of this, which is that it's really American and other companies who are seeking to make a profit and use educated workforces and existing infrastructure that's driving any type of expansion of technology in India, mm-hmm. and that the distribution of where that expansion takes place is perhaps indirectly related to corruption in government and the type of government, mm-hmm. but it's more directly related to the existence of an educated workforce and mm-hmm. existing infrastructure and availability of transport mechanisms.
Right.
How does that view fit in with your sort of research?
Yeah. So as I mentioned just briefly, the presence of technology companies doesn't seem to be related to the implementation of these services, nor does the technology infrastructure in a state, at least in as measured by teledensity. There aren't good measures of computer penetration or internet penetration at the state level in India, but there are measures of teledensity, so the number of telephones per 100 people. That doesn't seem to be related to at least the timing of implementation of these policies either. And I mean, I think it's an important question. Again, I think there is this sense here that because we're not expecting citizens to have to be educated to use these centers, the need for an educated workforce is only in the center, working in the centers themselves, because citizens interact with government in the same way, in many cases, that they would in a regular government office. So while I would expect that kind of, I might expect initially that kind of influence from multinational corporations or just the presence of the IT industry itself to have an effect, I haven't seen really strong evidence that it does have an effect on this particular kind of infrastructure development.
The list of states and which ones had the greatest penetration are the same states where American companies have chosen to do business.
Only
could be wrong about that.
Well, let's see. So this isn't penetration per se, it's quantity of services. So I don't have a slide that shows, you know, the number of centers that were implemented. But, you know, on the far right, Chhattisgarh, Himachal Pradesh is a Himalayan state, that there's a huge incentive for improved service delivery there because services access is very difficult because of the geographical characteristics of the state. I mean, Karnataka is relatively far up there, but
and Andhra Pradesh.
Yeah,
like
and
the two
Andhra.
Biggest. In fact, they're the big locations. There really isn't
right,
like,
that,
it's not like a progression of distribution.
Well,
it's
Maharashtra like, has a huge, a relatively large IT industry as well. Tamil Nadu's is growing, and it's pretty far on the left. So it's pretty mixed up there.
I think if I should risk an answer to that, I think one possible reason could be that in places like Andhra Pradesh and most parts of India, we don't have companies that are actually creating technology or information technology products as opposed to just providing services. Mm. So the kind of, you know, for example, the Bhoomi project that she said is one of the few examples of, you know, them coming out with a means of computerizing and digitizing land records. But then in general, most of the Indian companies are not there creating products, but more just providing information technology services.
Right, but what they're doing is they're investing in the infrastructure that allows geographical dispersion. It allows people to have access to the internet. So if it weren't for American companies building that access, there wouldn't be any capability in the first place for the government to then provide any types of services. In general, is one view.
That's not true.
No,
that's wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's the one view. Right.
India is among the most vibrant places around. So there's lots of access.
I hate to put a lid on the discussion, but I think we should probably end the official portion of the webcast event and encourage people to stick around for more conversation afterwards. And also, just a quick plug announcement, the Cyber Scholars Working Group, which is sort of a arrangement between the Berkman Center and MIT and Yale's ISP project, I believe, is having its first meeting this evening at 6 o'clock. There's more information on the Berkman website, and you should all come. So thanks, everyone, and thanks very much.
Thank you very much.